I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There won't be an apology anytime soon from Anita Hill. The Brandeis law professor and former aide to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas says she told the truth in 1991 when, during his confirmation hearings, she accused Thomas of sexual harassment. And she says she has no intention of apologizing, despite a request from Thomas's wife, Virginia, who left a voicemail for Hill on October 9th, reportedly saying, "Good morning, Anita Hill. It's Ginny Thomas. I just wanted to reach across the airwaves and the years and asked you to consider something. I'd love you to consider an apology sometime and some full explanation of why you did what you did with my husband." Well, Hill initially thought the voicemail was a prank and turned it over to the FBI. Ginny Thomas has been increasingly active. Last year, she launched the conservative nonprofit group Liberty Central. It's an unprecedented move for a Supreme Court spouse. So let's take a closer look with Ken Vogel, senior reporter for Politico. Ken, first of all, what do you make of the call?
It's frankly a little bit bizarre for at least two reasons, Robin. First of all, Ginny Thomas has really worked hard to establish herself as sort of an independent player on the political scene, and in so doing has worked to kind of create an identity separate from that of her husband, with whom she is invariably linked. That's part of the reason that she's been able to collect such huge contributions for her group, her Tea Party group, Liberty Central. Additionally, she's sort of walked this line where she has tried to be a player in the Tea Party movement while simultaneously staying out of the spotlight because, I understand from folks close to her, she is wary of having her activism used against her husband. Here we have a rather clumsy and ham-handed move that is, no matter how you look at it, going to wind up in the news and in the spotlight, casting her in a way different from that which she has sort of sought to carve out here.
Well, you mentioned her activism. Let's listen to a little bit of sound from a FreedomWorks rally. This is, of course, Dick Armey's group that backs the Tea Party. This is on September 12th, and Ginny Thomas appeared wearing her signature Statue of Liberty foam hat.
"It is a pleasure to be with you. What an honor, and despite the lies from the other side, despite the intimidation, you are America's political first responders, and we thank you for coming out."
Ken Vogel, this is what's caused such criticism of Ginny Thomas. It's such obvious partisanship.
Yeah, that's right. And there are certainly legal ethics questions that could be raised, most notably because there is a real hot legal debate right now about the ability of nonprofits registered under Section 501(c)(4) of the IRS code to air ads that attack or explicitly support candidates. Her group, Liberty Central, is involved in this type of activism. And if a case like this winds its way up to the Supreme Court, there's a question about whether Clarence Thomas would have to recuse himself.
Well, and there have been questions in the past, long before she formed this new nonprofit, Liberty Central. Back in 2000, Ginny Thomas was involved in George W. Bush's transition team. Explain why that was controversial.
It was controversial because the outcome of the United States presidential election at that point between George W. Bush and Al Gore was before the Supreme Court, eventually came before the Supreme Court, and the justices were asked to decide basically on who would become the next president. And Justice Thomas did not recuse himself in that case, withdrew some criticism from liberals. It should be pointed out here, however, Robin, that there are other examples of politically active spouses of judges, and Ginny Thomas and her supporters most frequently point to Ed Rendell, the current governor of Pennsylvania and former Democratic National Committee chairman, whose wife Midge is a federal judge in Pennsylvania. So this is not without precedent. However, the degree of Ginny Thomas's involvement and her outspokenness on issues that could potentially come before her husband's court, those have all drawn attention to her activism.
Well, we understand one big difference, though, between Ginny Thomas and the Rendells is that Governor Rendell has to disclose direct contributions to his campaigns, whereas Ginny Thomas does not have to disclose who gives Liberty Central, her group, monies. What are the questions there?
This is, again, a very hot issue right now in our politics, because this United States Supreme Court decision allowed corporations and unions to spend money in a more direct way on politics than they had previously been able to do so. In some ways, Jenny Thomas's group and others like it are benefiting from this decision that Justice Clarence Thomas was in the majority on. This is in a case that was ruled on in January called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission that is very much shaping the 2010 midterm election season. Not only is her group benefiting from it, but it also raises these additional questions about whether we as the public should know and Clarence Thomas should know who is giving money to Jenny Thomas's group. As of now, we don't know that.
Ken Vogel of Politico, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, one of the most talked about ballot questions this fall is California's Proposition 19, which asks if marijuana should be legalized for recreational use, taxed and sold in retail stores just like alcohol. Supporters say Prop 19 could generate more than $1 billion in revenue for cash-strapped California. Detractors say it would be devastating for the addicted. But voters may not have a last say. Unlike alcohol, which is regulated by states, drugs are regulated at the federal level, and it's expected that the U.S. government will sue if the question passes in California, and that federal agents will crack down on the recreational marijuana industry in California, much as they did after voters there passed the medical marijuana law back in 1996. We want to talk a little bit about Prop 19 today. Joining us, Peter Hecht. He writes the Weed Wars blog for the Sacramento Bee. And Peter, you know, right there, an entire blog devoted to this. How big is the current marijuana industry in California, the medical marijuana industry in California?
Well, it has taken off as a major cultural phenomenon with enormous political and legal implications and also tremendous entrepreneurial vitality. And what happened is last year was an explosion of medical marijuana dispensaries up and down California's coast and its cities and urban centers. And there were a small number of dispensaries years ago, but when the Obama Justice Department signaled that it would not target legal medical marijuana use in states where it is sanctioned, there was an explosion in the industry. And even though under California law it's a nonprofit industry, it essentially accounts for $1.3 billion in total marijuana transactions. So
wow.
It's a fairly incredible phenomenon.
Now, you mentioned something that is worth underscoring. Right after the medical marijuana laws were passed in California, there were federal raids on these facilities. But then, as you said, the Obama administration signaled that that would stop because the medical marijuana laws were state-sanctioned. And also, this new question about recreational use. We should say Massachusetts, where we are, is one of 12 states that's decriminalized marijuana. In other words, here you can have less than an ounce and pay only a small fine. There's no criminal charge. Governor Schwarzenegger had also already decriminalized small amounts in California. But this new ballot question goes beyond that. What would the new ballot question do?
On paper, it's really wide open. It's going to allow local cities and local governments to tax retail marijuana sales and open up a whole new industry on top of the existing medical marijuana trade. Besides that, individuals can cultivate marijuana in private homes in a 5x5 growing space or 25 square feet. You can legally possess, walk around with up to an ounce of marijuana. The latter two, the private cultivation and the personal use, will probably stand if this passes, but the retail sales are really going to be tricky since Eric Holder announced last Friday that he's going to continue to try to enforce federal drug laws, and that means a lot of challenges around these retail establishments should they spring up.
And by the way, the allowances in the new ballot question would only apply if you're 21 and older. But as you said, there's such a long road ahead. There's going to have to be a whole infrastructure set up just to tax the retail sales of drugs. There's still going to have to be some sort of licensing because there are people who are not going to want to become part of an infrastructure. They're still going to want to do it, you know, under the table. And as you said, this probably will go all the way to the Supreme Court.
It may well. And there were two cases under the medical marijuana law that did, in fact, go to the U.S. Supreme Court. In both cases, federal authority was upheld. What happened, though, it was more of a political evolution that changed the tide.
That's not as likely when it's not medical use, but rather recreational use. And let's just talk about why proponents say that this is a good idea. They say, first of all, it'll help with California's budget crunch. They say that it'll bring a huge windfall. They also say that it will cut down on the high costs in so many ways of the Mexican drug wars. What's been the response to that?
Well, the most significant thing to come out on that was last week's study by the renowned Santa Monica think tank, the RAND Corporation, which essentially said that legalizing marijuana in California would have little impact on the Mexican drug cartels unless Californians and eager tourists who come to California to purchase their pot begin trafficking it in droves across the United States. Only then would we see a significant dent in Mexican drug cartel revenue. So that would be a pretty interesting scenario.
Who's opposed to this?
Very traditional law enforcement groups, anti-drug addiction groups, the usual suspects that you would expect.
But we also read in your blog, many in the medical marijuana industry are opposed to Prop 19 and the legalization of recreational use of marijuana. Why?
That's true. And it is split. There are a couple different schools of thought. I do believe some of them are very much believers in medical marijuana use and are not interested in taking the extra step into a broader retail trade. There are others for whom arguments are being made that they're being disingenuous, that they have a very good thing going, even though medical marijuana is, under California law, supposed to be a not-for-profit operations. Many of these outlets generate millions of dollars in sales. One outlet in Oakland alone generates $20 million annually in transactions. So that covers a lot of employees, a lot of salaries. Some of them are fairly generous, and there's no question that some of these places probably want to protect what they have going on. Others, though, are motivated more by their belief that marijuana is medicine and is not something that should be trifled with for recreational use. Yeah. So California, the interesting thing to understand about California is California has an enormous legal marijuana industry right now. So when you talk about infrastructure of implementing Proposition 19, I've been in commercial production centers for medical marijuana that are unionized and paying union-scale wages. You have a dispensary industry that is estimated to produce $1.3 billion in transactions, even though they're not called sales. So you actually have enormous infrastructure that, in some cases, could convert over to legal recreational use. In other cases, many of the places would not want to. But the enormity of the industry out here, the legal industry, is amazing.
And again, right now, that legal marijuana industry in California is medical marijuana, but passage of Prop 19 would okay recreational use for people over 21. That's Peter Hecht. He writes the Weed Wars blog for the Sacramento Bee. When we come back, what are the gubernatorial candidates saying, or not saying, about Prop 19? And later, a judge with a big decision in Oregon. Back after a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with reporter Peter Hecht of the Sacramento Bee about Prop 19, which is on the California ballot on November 2nd. The state approved medical marijuana use back in 1996, but Prop 19 asks voters whether or not the recreational use of marijuana should be approved, and polls indicate they will say yes. Here's an ad that supports Prop 19. It was produced by the group Normal, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
In order to ensure our children have a bright and prosperous future, we propose that the revenue from the legalization of marijuana can be used to supplement the education system in California.
Addiction has become an epidemic in the United States, and California is no exception.
Revenue from the legalization of marijuana should be used to fund addiction treatment centers and give California an opportunity to be on the forefront of the cure to addiction, as opposed to the leader in incarceration.
The legalization
But there are opponents, including people who work with the drug addicted, and members of law enforcement who are speaking out against Prop 19. Here's Kim Rainey, police chief in Covina, California, speaking to Fox News.
This is one of the most devastating initiatives ever to hit California, and that's why the 350 municipal police chiefs in this state are dead set against this this initiative and are fighting to oppose it.
Police Chief Kim Rainey of Covina, California. Peter Hecht, at the Sacramento Bee, you've outlined some of the challenges for us, but we're also wondering, what will it look and feel like if Prop 19 passes? Will there be Amsterdam-like pot dens or pot drive-thrus? And will some sort of blood test have to be devised by police in order to test people for driving under the influence? Is there a sense that this is going to move into the place that alcohol now occupies?
Well, in terms of driving, one thing to understand is that you have hundreds of thousands of Californians already smoking marijuana daily, presumably on the road. Police are able to arrest people for driving while impaired, but there is not the the easy standard, such as a blood alcohol rating, that you find with alcohol. Some of the marijuana people say that there is research and technology available that can at least detect if you've smoked in the past several hours, as opposed to having something in your bloodstream from weeks past. But that is an issue, is how would you determine if someone is not just impaired, but to what level they may be impaired.
Could it make it that they, like, call you dude a lot because this is California? They might do that anyway.
Oh, we don't need weed to call each other dude.
That's right. What have the gubernatorial candidates said about Prop 19?
No mainstream political candidate in California will get near this. They are all against it. And the ones that are for it, there are some lawmakers from San Francisco where the medical marijuana movement, going back many years, sort of morphed in with the gay rights movement because there were a number of AIDS and HIV patients that were getting relief from medical marijuana. So there are some key lawmakers that support this from San Francisco, but the mainstream candidates of both parties, they're all against it. Jerry Brown, the leading Democrat, the Democratic nominee, says, how can we compete with China if we're all going to be stoned?
Jerry Brown says that?
Yes.
Interesting.
The irony is that if there is a big turnout for Prop 19, in favor of Prop 19, Jerry Brown is probably the next governor, even though he's very much against the initiative.
Yes. Take a second for people to paint out the graph. But one last question, Peter Hecht. You say that many former police chiefs are for legalizing marijuana for recreational use.
Well, it's hard to gauge the percentage. The notable distinction between in law enforcement groups of those who are for it and those who are against it, if you have a former or a retired in front of your name, you appear to be more likely to favor legalization. The existing groups, the police chiefs associations, the narcotics officers associations, the sheriff's associations, virtually every meaningful law enforcement group is adamantly against this. But there are a number of individuals led by former San Jose Police Chief Joseph McNamara. There's a retired Orange County Superior Court judge. There's a retired Deputy Los Angeles Police Chief that have said the resources and expense put into marijuana enforcement are not worth the benefits, and we need a new approach. But again, they're retired.
Peter Hecht, a reporter with the Sacramento Bee in California, author of that paper's blog, Weed Wars, on Prop 19, the question that will be before voters on the ballot in California, would they approve of legalizing the recreational use of marijuana? And right now, polls show that they will. By the way, I just want to ask you this. Do people there, do they express guilt about using marijuana and having, you know, people macheted in Mexico?
No. Because California, at least most of the people that I'm reporting on, we're dealing with homegrown California marijuana grown by networks of Californians, marijuana patients that are associated with these dispensaries. So they see themselves competing with the violent cartels. They see themselves as an alternative to that. There are illicit networks, often with illegal immigrants. the Mexican cartels that are operating California forests and public lands. What people from the DEA have tended to tell me is most of that marijuana goes to other parts of the country, not to California.
Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, beside the recreational marijuana use question in California, there are medical marijuana measures on the ballot in Arizona and Oregon. In fact, there are 160 questions on ballots in 38 states this fall. They're listed on the website Ballotpedia, but here are some. Amendment 62 in Colorado would define a fertilized egg as a person. State question 756 in Oklahoma allows residents to get out of health care mandates. Arizona and Colorado voters have similar questions. Surely some challenges will follow there. Voters in Oklahoma will also be asked to declare that English is the state's official language. And in Illinois, there's an amendment that creates a system under which the governor can be recalled. We'll link you to Ballotpedia at our website, hereandnow.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll touch down in Pennsylvania as a new poll shows Democrat Joe Sestak gaining some ground on Republican Pat Toomey in the U.S. Senate race. Also, a new Sherlock Holmes comes to PBS and he has a smartphone. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, they're sort of the musical spawn of Laurie Anderson and Lou Reed, the group The Books. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. They're calling it Axe Wednesday, the largest cuts to British public spending since World War II, slashing as many as 500,000 public sector jobs as part of a five-year austerity plan outlined today by British Treasury Chief George Osborne. The cuts total $130 billion and even include the Queen. The royal household budget will be reduced by 14% over 4 years. The plan is supposed to help Britain wipe out a budget deficit that topped $200 billion last year. The BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson joins us with more. And Rob, these cuts were not unexpected, but still, how are people reacting?
You're absolutely right. They weren't unexpected in the sense that we have a budget process in Britain, and that happened in June, where the Chancellor, the government, set out what its targets were. But this was all about, okay, well, exactly where are you going to find the savings? Where is the X going to come? Where is it going to fall in terms of things that voters notice, like policing, like welfare payments and all those kinds of things. Now, in terms of the reaction, well, in many ways, in popular terms, it's still coming in. And don't forget that an awful lot of people won't really understand quite what this means or won't be directly affected by it for some time. So the public are still mulling this one over. Opinion polls suggest that the public in Britain kind of gets the need to have cuts. As for the political reaction, well, as you can imagine, the coalition between the Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats, they've rallied behind these very, very painful decisions. And the opposition Labour Party has said, well, you've gone too fast and too quickly.
Opposition leader Ed Miliband said this represents an irresponsible gamble for jobs and the economy. And it comes as France has seen street protests and strikes because of a plan to raise the retirement age. Is there a sense that there are Brits who will take to the streets?
It's a very, very good question. My sense is certainly not to the extent as in France. Now, what do I base that on? Well, I base it really on these opinion polls that I was talking about. They do tend to suggest that the British government has won a very important argument, at least to this point with the British voters, and that is that, look, these cuts are unavoidable because the coalition has made this pitch saying Britain is on the edge of a sort of debt precipice. There are all sorts of dangers if we don't start paying it back. The interest payments are huge. And I think the polls tend to suggest that people sort of get that. Now, when some of the cuts come into effect, if people start losing jobs on a large scale, could there be trouble on the streets? Could there be union protests? Well, of course, and indeed the trade union movement in Britain has said that it is steadfastly opposed to the scale of cuts in public spending.
And we know the British labour unions marched on Parliament yesterday in anticipation of the cuts that were going to be announced today. But still, you're going to see hundreds of London-based diplomats lose their jobs under a cut to the foreign ministry's budget. So the cuts are sort of across almost a class continuum. But what about, especially with the terror threats increasingly coming out towards Europe, is there a sense that military or security spending will be cut?
the overall defence budget is certainly being cut. That's getting cuts of about 8%. Now, that is much less than some other departments are facing. But one of the areas that the government is very keen to protect is Britain's intelligence services and Britain's special operations forces within the military. Now, of course, that is of huge interest to the United States government, because one of the biggest areas of cooperation between the US and the UK is over areas of intelligence. And one of the things that the United States particularly relies on in Afghanistan and formerly in Iraq was the use of British special forces.
Well, we understand taxes are also going to be increased. Who's being targeted?
There'll be a rate of 50% tax on the better off, those earning $200,000. And they're going to be new sort of payroll taxes, social security taxes for most people in employment. So I saw a story yesterday about thousands of hedge fund managers have already decided to leave the UK. And whatever you might think about these people, you know, the point is that, you know, they pay 40% of their salaries in taxes. So even if they're very, very large, that does actually contribute a lot of money to the Treasury.
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch from here across the pond, where there are, of course, lawmakers who'd like to do the same thing, and it would be considered political death. Rob Watson, the BBC's political correspondent. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And coming up, a judge considers the case of Oregon National Guard vets suing contractor KBR. They claim KBR exposed them to cancer-causing chemicals in Iraq. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. A federal judge today is hearing a case involving 26 National Guard vets from Oregon who claim that military contractor Kellogg Brown and Root, or KBR, exposed them to a cancer-causing chemical at a water treatment plant in Iraq early in the war. The veterans say that a rust inhibitor used at the plant, the salt sodium dichromate, contained the carcinogen, hexavacronium, the same chemical that crusading lawyer Aaron Brockovich made infamous in the 1990s. Vet Larry Roberta told MSNBC that he now has what is called reactive airway disorder. Depending on which doctor you talk to, it's also called a disease. He says he has to use two types of inhalers. He has serious migraine headaches, and some vets are much sicker. KBR flatly denies the accusations. All told, about 180 vets and engineers from several states and Britain are suing. But the lawsuit brought by Oregon vets has gone the furthest in court. So let's take a look with Julie Sullivan. She's staff writer at The Oregonian. Her reports on hexavalent chromium helped lead to the creation of a state fund in Oregon and a national VA registry for affected vets. She joins us from the studios of Palatine Recordings in Portland, Oregon. Julie, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, now, a federal judge has already ruled that the Oregon vets case can go forward. But what is the issue the judge is hearing today?
Well, the issue is KBR has taken the rather unusual step of asking if they can appeal the case before it ever goes to trial. This is sort of a legal strategy in which they're asking the judge to give them permission to go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Essentially, the company claims that the case involves national security and national policy and questions of jurisdiction that should be heard by the higher court. They're doing this, and it would essentially stop all depositions and stop the case, perhaps for up to a year. The judge has already ruled twice that the federal court in Oregon does have the jurisdiction and ability to hear the case.
Well, tell us more about what KBR says in response to the claims, because they have a fact sheet that they hand out. They say it's not true that they ignored the presence of sodium dichromate. They say that they notified the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers when they found it at the facility. They say that it was in the facility because the Iraqis left it behind. They say that they posted signs in Arabic and English in around the facility stating that it was there and that it was toxic. Tell us more about what they're saying in their own defense.
They're also claiming that, essentially, contractors doing the work of the military should enjoy some of the legal protection that the military enjoys. They also claim they were working in a war zone and that in the midst of and the chaos of combat operations, they could not be, you know, held liable for negligence when they were essentially risking their lives to restore Iraqi oil. Their claim is also that they have provided this invaluable service. The change in the use of contractors during the war is really really what's at the heart of this case.
Well, in fact, you report that during depositions in a court in Portland, a KBR attorney revealed that he'd secured a secret agreement with the government that requires taxpayers, not KBR, to pay for any death, injury, or property damage during the Iraqi contract. Now, there are now some Oregon lawmakers who are filing a bill that would revoke this immunity for harm from a contractor. But it would seem that, given that, they may have a case that they can't be held liable.
Well, this sweetheart deal, which really did happen on the eve of the invasion, it would seem that taxpayers are on the hook. And, of course, the Oregon delegation sort of went ballistic over this and saying, wait a minute, what other sweetheart deals are out there and secret deals? Because all of this has remained classified. There's some indication that the Army would fight that indemnity clause because, of course, at the heart of KBR's defense is that the Corps of Engineers who signed the contract with the company was ultimately responsible for the safety at the plant, whereas the Army, of course, would claim that it was the contractor doing the work there.
Well, either way, KBR also denies the allegations of health problems that the workers are making. They say the allegation is that soldiers and KBR workers suffered from nosebleeds, respiratory problems, as we heard, caused by the sodium dichromate, and that none of the medical data support these claims. You've spoken to some of these soldiers. How sick are they? Have any died? What's your sense of their illness?
Well, I think there's absolutely no question that people are sick and very sick. And these were people who were really in the prime of their life. They were soldiers who, according to interviews I've done, as well as testimony before the state legislature and before the Senate Democratic Policy Committee, soldiers experienced things as sort of hideous as holes in their nose, in their septums that developed shortly after they arrived. They actually call it chrome nose, toxicologists do. And these soldiers who were really in prime physical condition were suddenly, after their experience, they're unable to, you know, walk to the mailbox, doing about 40% of their job. I've also sat in the living room of the parents of Nicholas Thomas, who was a 21-year-old Oregon Army National Guardsman who died of leukemia after serving at Karmat Ali. And I'm not sure that we'll ever know the connection there, but two other Indiana Guardsmen, including the commander of the unit, have also died of sort of rare lung disorders or cancer.
Well, Julie, could you just explain one discrepancy to us? KBR says it did post signage around the facility warning that there was a toxic chemical there, but you've reported that while KBR warned the Army Corps of Engineers of the toxic chemical, they didn't warn the Pentagon or soldiers, and the Oregon Guard wasn't notified until 2 months after they arrived at Karmat Ali, the facility. And the soldiers themselves only found out about their exposure when KBR employees testified about health problems at a Senate hearing in 2008. So square that with KBR claiming they put warning signs.
Well, I wasn't there, and I honestly cannot explain how they posted warning signs. It might have happened after a safety manager arrived at the plant in July of 2003 and became very sick himself with breathing problems and became very alarmed and immediately raised concerns. He also became alarmed because, according to testimony he's given, he said that there, it was well understood at KBR, they had actually exchanged memos, that there was this very toxic chemical. It was dust. It coated everything. It blew in people's faces. It blew in their hair. It blew into their water. It blew into the MREs, the meals ready to eat that they were feeding the soldiers. The case hinges on when people knew and what they knew. And there is evidence that as early as March 2003, before the company or any of the National Guard ever went in there, that the United Nations team had identified the presence of hexavalent chromium at the Karmat Ali plant.
Julie Sullivan, staff writer at The Oregonian. We'll link you to her writing at our website, hereandnow.org. Julie, thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. That's the two-person group, The Books, One plays cello, the other guitar, but then they bend their own sounds and add others. Electronica, voices, tons of obscure found sound.
At this extraordinary time in history, when consciousness is exploding and developing, take the room that you need to rotate and love.
The books are currently on tour supporting their new release, The Way Out. Here and Now's Andrea Shea caught up with them in North Adams, Massachusetts, where the books make much of their music.
The books came together 11 years ago in New York City over a common obsession, randomly discovered cassettes, LPs, and videotapes. Like audio alchemists, cellist Paul DeYoung and guitarist Nick Zamuto meticulously transform voice samples, instruments, electronics, and odd effects into seamless collages of sound.
65 because I just want, he kept calling me at night, all hours of the night, calling my husband, my brother, calling me every day, he's after me, and I was devastated, I was without a job, without a salary.
This is from the book's first album, Thought for Food. The duo crafted it remotely, talking on the phone and sending audio CDs back and forth in the mail. Much of their second album, The Lemon of Pink, was recorded and mixed in North Adams, a depressed Massachusetts town hard hit by factory closings. Zamuto moved here in 2002 and offered to show me the dumpy apartment building he lived in while making The Lemon of Pink.
So this was the building, and as you can see, it's an absolute disaster. There's like squirrel holes in my apartment now, and shingles are falling off, and there are probably 8 apartments in this building.
Zamuto says he labored for 5 months making The Lemon of Pink in an 8-by-10-foot pantry.
A big pantry. So I would actually sit on an electric heater while I worked in the wintertime.
Apparently, tight spaces can create lush, thoughtful sounds. The Lemon of Pink is textured and detailed, and the critics loved it.
The Lemon of Pink.
You've got these guys who are excellent sound engineers who are paying attention to like the smallest details of the sonic experience and layering in so much stuff, but at the end of the day, it sounds actually rather simple and sublime.
That's Chris Dahlin, contributing writer for the independent music website Pitchfork.
There's no one I would really say that's like them. You know, they're kind of sample artists, but they have the souls of folk musicians. They have such an acoustic and organic sound.
These days, Nick Zamuto feels a sense of loyalty to North Adams for the time he spent here making The Lemon of Pink.
It was after that record where we really started touring, and at that point, the music became a livelihood, so I guess it was a good investment to live here.
And it paid off. Now Zamuto lives in a beautiful farmhouse just over the border in Vermont. Paul DeYoung lives outside Albany, New York. They still work long distance, meeting about once a week in North Adams. Their office space is overrun with stacks and chaotic piles of old video and audio cassettes. We sift through the building blocks of what the books do.
From the Zig Ziglar Corporation. Let's see. Zig Story?
Oh, Zig Ziglar.
Attitude
yeah.
Makes the difference.
Pretty cool.
Let's try the B-sides different.
Wow, these are amazing.
Yeah, I mean, setting your goals.
Techniques for happier living.
Oh, you see, we should have used that. missed that one. It's not all self-help.
But a lot is. DeYoung does most of the collecting. He scours thrift stores and flea markets all over the world, hunting for the most obscure self-made productions.
Hello, greetings, and welcome. Welcome to a new beginning. For this tape will serve you as a new beginning. That's right, a new beginning, as we're about ready to begin.
Self-help gurus run through this song, Group Autogenics 1.
On this recording, music specifically created for its pleasurable effects upon your mind, body, and emotions is mixed with a warm orange-colored liquid.
Then there are the answering machine cassettes.
Hello, Mary. Call to wish you a good evening and wish you a good rest and tell you how much I enjoyed your company last evening.
And private recordings. Listen to what the books did with this old found tape of what sounds like a young brother and sister fighting.
How? Why do you always get away with things? It's not fair, I tell you. It's not fair. I want to blow your brains out with...
Music critic Chris Dahlin says this piece, called A Cold Freezing Night, really illustrates why the books can be so provocative.
As long as I want you to.
They frame it in this really intense, engaging piece of music. But when you listen to the voices, it's kind of up to you to figure out, you know, do you find it kind of funny? Do you smile in recognition? Or do you find it kind of horrifying, these violent things kids say to each other? You know, we're kind of eavesdropping in on these two kids, but it's kind of up to all of us to figure out, what is this? What are we listening to?
I wish I was a boy. Kill him. I'm gonna kill you. I'm gonna rip your hair off. I'm gonna get bald.
Even the books have no idea about any of the people's voices in their songs. They rip them out of context, but somehow make some sort of emotional sense out of them. Then there's the story of hip-hop. Both musicians say the Found LP is a standout.
All right, now. Shh. I have the nicest surprise for you, but you first must wash your face and get ready.
It's a children's record that was produced by the Rosicrucians.
Listen carefully.
That record, I remember hearing it in the van the first time. We were just going through digitized material and kind of previewing it.
I want to tell you a story about hip-hop. Hello, little hip-hop.
And it's a matter of digitizing, throwing out what you don't need, and then carefully cutting words apart and completely reformulating a narrative.
The unbelievable sort of cosmic yet anachronistic coincidence of that sample. I mean, it's from the 50s, so it predates hip-hop by 20 years. We had to make a track out of it, even if we had to kind of bend the rules about the genre that we usually fall within. And we don't usually work with breakbeats.
He lived with his sister, Skip Hop.
It's incredibly rare. I've never seen anything like it.
Where did you find it?
You know, somewhere in America, in a record store, that I know. It was not in a thrift store because I don't really go through LPs in thrift stores because, you have to go through like 10,000 classic rock albums to find like one spoken word album that's usually the one that you already have because it's JFK. So I kind of don't want to do it anymore.
And even the flowers talk to each other like people do, but the sounds they make are different. Listen carefully and try to understand what they say.
We haven't even gotten into what the books do with found video, but it is fascinating to consider why their music can be so affecting. The voice samples they choose and arrange are laced with irony, but the books never make fun of people. It's all very human. Even the self-help samples manage to soothe you while making you laugh, maybe even at yourself.
Stare at yourself in the mirror until you feel a burning sensation.
That's Here and Now's Andrea Shea. The book's new CD is The Way Out. To see how the group incorporates found video and sound into its compositions, go to hereandnow.org. And for our listeners here in the Boston area, the books play tomorrow night at the Somerville Theater.
And imagine your own